from meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news. Broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Nice to have you. My next guest is a retired Federal Treasury agent. He has a PhD in biblical studies. He is an author, and one of the books that he wrote is best-selling, As America Has Done to Israel. And I thought I'd bring him on tonight with the refugee crisis in Europe and talk about the topic, Islam's conquest of Europe. And it's a big kick to have John McTernan on the show. Welcome, sir. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing very well, and I'm delighted to be on your show, and thank you for having me.
Now, we're going to just go off topic a little bit, I guess, for a minute or two, and I want to get your thoughts on Ben Carson and his recent comments on the presidency and Muslims, I guess.
Well, for some reason, and I can't quite figure this out, the West, I'm talking about the United States, Canada, and Europe, Australia, New Zealand, the English, Europe, not all of it, they have a hard time, difficult time, recognizing Islam from reality of it to what's presented. Now, when we look at Islam, all you have to do is put Sunni Islam is look at Saudi Arabia, and for Shiite Islam, just look at Iran. And of course, there's Islamic states, other Islamic states we can look at, but there is no freedom really outside of Islam. Women are subjugated. If Saudi Arabia, you try and walk down the street of it. Well, first of all, you can't go to Mecca. You're an unbeliever. You're not allowed. But if you walk down the street with showing a cross on your neck, holding a Bible, these are serious offenses. A convert, the Lord in Saudi Arabia, killed. And there have been many that would have been bought. Their ransom has been bought. They're allowed to go to the country. This is coming from Iran. It's coming from secondary writings called the Hadith. There, Mohammed taught this, and yet somehow the West, if you got Islam, you're evil and you're intolerant, a bigot. Some sort of, with the media in the West and a lot of the politics, is some sort of, they're enamored with Islam. So it's a very dangerous situation, and Ben Carson has spoken true. Because if a Muslim is elected president, and in the United States, by the way, the Constitution says there is no religion, like qualifications. You can't, religion can't be held against you for qualifications.
Right.
So a Muslim like that has every ability, a right to run, can't stop him. If a president acts Muslim faith and invokes Sharia law, it is direct against the Constitution of the United States. The First Amendment says we have freedom of speech, we have rights, assembly, and things like that. And under Islam, under Sharia law, you don't have that. You don't have that. And there are many other things that are in direct conflict with the United States our Constitution. So, yes, I agree with Carson absolutely 100%.
Well, with the John McTernan's here, and you can learn more about John by going to his website, usaprophecy.com. But with the liberal-dominated media, do you think that he was, and I applaud him for his courage to stick to his answer, where a lot of politicians don't. But do you think that he was set up with this question because, you know that the liberals were going to jump on that answer no matter what he said?
Yes, I think it was a setup. And the good thing about Morrison, and I'm not promoting anyone, and Donald Trump, but I'm not promoting anyone. I'm just commenting on what's going on. Is that they're holding their ground. So when Morrison says right, he won't walk back. Said it forces the liberal media then out in the open. Say, well, why are you against Muslim people?
Yeah.
That's dangerous ground, because if he starts telling it about Sharia law and what's written in the Quran and the Hadiths, that is, they're defenseless against that. What are they going to say? That, well, that's not in the Quran when it is. Muslims don't believe it when they do. So you take slavery, for example. I mean, slavery's... Mohammed was a slave dealer himself, and slavery is in the Quran. It's a part of Islam. They have slavery going on now in North Africa. They've tried to stop. Saudi Arabia just officially abolished it, but everything I read, they still slavery in Saudi Arabia. They abolished it like 1903.
Yeah, that's just crazy.
And the British, by the way, when the British were in their imperial days and they were parts of Africa, well, today, Ethiopia and Sudan, they put an end to it as late as 1806. General Gordon, he was the one that officially put an end to slavery in Muslim countries in North Africa. Now, it's been reinstituted. I understand Gaddafi, the form of slavery going on there, and it's the Muslim country where they refuse to give it up.
Exactly. Right. And when we look at the refugee crisis, and our topic this evening is Islam's conquest of Europe, you can say what you want about George W. Bush and Iraq and all that sort of stuff, but the current administration in the United States has totally blown it. Now we see a refugee crisis that parallels or is probably going to be worse than World War II. I know the Germans have stepped up, and of course John Kerry loves to get into the media after the fact and try and make himself look good, but what about that? What about this refugee crisis that we're seeing? How bad is it going to be?
Well, it's stabilizing, it's going to destabilize Europe because their economy is very frail right now to start off. There are a number of economies that are ready to go under.
Right.
And these people, when they come in, they're refugees, they don't speak the language. The unemployment is very high. Italy and Greece and Spain and many of the other countries. How are they going to pay for it? How are they going to provide for them? So it's going to put an enormous strain on the economies. And Muslims do not assimilate in society. At the beginning, when they first come in, it may seem that way. But as time goes on, I mean, the French have learned that, and the British have learned that. You take, pretty soon, I've heard and I've read things about London, they're going to be calling it London Stan. And Paris, the same thing, where Muslims have not assimilated. They have their own neighborhoods. They grow in those neighborhoods, link up to them. They have strongholds. They have their own, little, sub-nations within the nation. They want to deny this. And there's nothing to deny. It's out in the open. See it. So all these Muslims that are coming in, they won't assimilate for countries. They won't assimilate. They're just going to add little city-state that are building into the country. And all of Islam, whether they're Shiites, whether they're Sunnis, anybody that, they believe in world conquest of Islam, that Islam is going to conquer the world. And one of the ways is through immigration. And Mohammed wrote about it, and he told them to immigrate, immigration, and Allah will provide the open there. And so Muslims do that. They go into areas, part of their conquest of the world, some of it's military, some of it like ideas, some of it is through assimilation and setting up Muslim states and nations.
You know, we hear so much in the media about Syria, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, but there's so much more. A lot of people don't realize that the Africa is a billion people, and the potential of mass disaster is so huge. What about that? What about, we talked a little bit about the media and how they're covering things. We all saw the video of the poor boy who drowned, and then all of a sudden the governments start to say, okay, now we saw this, we're going to wake up. What about that? What's the real story?
The real story, I get, you know, look, that's heart-wrenching.
Yeah.
But the real story, it's like propaganda.
Yeah.
Why doesn't, here's a good question. Those refugees are in Syria. Syria is not far from Saudi Arabia. Why hasn't the United Arab, why hasn't, but Jordan has, and Turkey has. But Saudi Arabia, that huge space, a very small population, they take them all in, right? No, they don't. I believe Saudi Arabia, for its reason, and ISIS, for its reason, they want to squeeze these immigrate to Europe. And again, it's part of world conquest. I'm not making this up. It's in their writings. It's out in the open for anybody to see. Saudi Arabia has its belief in how Islam's going to come. Iran has different. ISIS, they all have one goal, world conquest.
Yeah, and that world conquest is coming right around the corner. Now, it's easy to sit down and make predictions whether they're right or wrong, but it's also very easy to look at the facts, and I'll ask you this before we finish up. What your prediction will be as far as where this will go?
Well, I think it's going, we're heading towards a massive war. I think we're going to see, I don't think I'm sort of in the stages of a civil war like it was 1,000 years ago. Both want to form a caliphate, and from that caliphate, because ISIS wants a caliphate, so does Iran, by Islam, and they will be serious. They're going to go at, I believe they're going also go at Europe. So many in Europe now, and Europe is so weak that Islam gain either huge footholds, especially in Europe, or actually take over countries.
And they're doing that now.
Islam. We're looking at Islam like in the 7th century. That's what's forming right in front of our eyes. Islam that was spread throughout part of the known world by conquest. They call it God.
You know, when you hear, and I'll give you the last word, but in the article that I'm reading here, it's in quotations, liberalism is the ideology of Western suicide. So true. And what can we, as a nation, as a people, at my age, you know, my children and my grandchildren will have to continue on with this battle, so to speak, but what can we do to try and turn the course, or is it just gone too far?
Well, I think it's at the point where it's gone too far for many nations. I don't think it's gone too far for Canada. I don't think it's gone too far for America, although it doesn't take Muslims, if uprising, to wreak havoc. But ultimately, this is a spiritual battle, and we need help God's Holy Spirit on our nation. Stop what it. Otherwise, there's countries in Europe now. 50% of the children that are born, like Belgium, and Denmark are Muslim, and the most popular name now in Denmark, Britain, is Mohammed.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be interesting. Listen, John McTernan, his website, usaprophecy.com. You can learn about more about this topic and others. Thank you, sir. I appreciate your time, and maybe we can do this again soon.
Oh, sure. Anytime. Well, listen, God bless you and your listeners.
Thank you. Take care. That's John McTernan. And again, you can check out his website by going to usaprophecy.com. And okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show on Access 7 and Scared Monkeys Radio, of course. My next guest is an internationally known privacy researcher, consumer advocate, best-selling author, radio host. She's done a little bit of everything. And we're going to talk to her, Catherine Albrecht, about RFID, and we're going to talk to her about privacy and Facebook and social media and all this stuff. It's an electronic age right now, and there are huge dangers as far as the use of social media, Facebook and privacy and you name it. And Catherine, welcome to the program.
Hey, Dana. It's so good to be on with you. You know, there are so many privacy threats coming from so many different directions with all the new technologies. It's kind of hard to know what direction to even turn your attention. But there are a few trends that I think people need to be aware of. And one of them is the trend for an increasing amount of surveillance to be built everyday objects, things that we're used to thinking of as, you know, I own this and it's in my house and in the privacy of my own home, you can't really know what I'm doing. And there's a trend now to, because computerization has become so widespread and so inexpensive, to actually build not only computerization and software into everyday objects, but to allow them to communicate through this increasing Wi-Fi network and the satellite network and sort of the global brain transmitting everything that you do in the privacy of your own home to authorities so that they can actually monitor what you're doing. And the key word that people want to be looking out for is the word smart. So you think smart, well, that sounds great. Like, let's get a college degree and we'll be really smart about it. But when you hear about a smartphone, yeah, or when you hear about a smart toaster or a smart medicine tablet or smart really anything, means that it's got the capability of transmitting information to some third party. And we've heard about the smart Samsung TVs that, right, actually can listen to you in your own living room. They've actually got microphones built into them, and they transmit your conversation as you're watching TV and you're conversing with your wife or with your kids. They're transmitting all of that to unknown third parties. And that's the smart TV. And the list just goes on and on of these so-called smart, or really what I call spy devices in our homes.
Catherine Albrecht's here. And you bring up a good point. I go back to the era of, I remember when the VCR first came out and the 1,700 hours it took to even figure out how to set the clock on the darn thing.
That's right. They were all blinking all day long.
So
yeah.
I figured it 8888 is good enough for the time. And now we have smart everything. And when it comes right down to it with the technology that we have nowadays, watches and this and that, this isn't something that we're going to be able to get away from. People are putting out thousands and millions of dollars a year to get these devices, but what can we do to protect ourselves in the use of them?
Yeah, I think part of it is just in a level of awareness, and it's kind of like boiling the frog. Things that our generation would have considered unfathomable 20 years ago are now considered par for the course and an everyday standard for young people. So I think there's a responsibility that those of us who grew up in a different generation where our devices and our appliances were not spying on us and sending messages back to authorities and marketers and hackers and who knows who, so that they could spy on us, I think we need to speak out and say, wait a minute, this is not the way the world's always been. This certainly isn't the way the world should be, and we need to take active steps to try to do something about it. And I'll give you just a couple of examples of things that are being promoted as cool and sexy and high-tech and awesome that are really awful.
Sure.
One of them is the Dropcam. Are you familiar with Dropcam? It's Google's new $99 computer camera, computerized camera. You can actually plug it into the USB port on your computer, you can put it in any room of your home, And it's basically a surveillance camera inside your house. So remember how creepy it felt when we first saw surveillance cameras on public streets, or first saw them in the bank, or first saw them in a restaurant or a bar.
Sure.
Well, now they want to extend that ability to watch everything that happens, listen to every word that gets spoken, into your very home. And the drop cam is really disturbing for a bunch of reasons, but the main reason is that if you pay a fee, you can actually have Google record all of the audio and video that happens 24 hours a day inside your home in front of the drop cam, and it all is stored on the Google servers. And we know from Ed Snowden that the NSA, the USA courts, that certainly law enforcement here has an overzealous attitude about accessing anything stored on Google servers. And so the idea that somehow every conversation you would have over dinner, every conversation, some people have even put these in their bedrooms so they can actually watch you in your nightgown as you go to bed, as you brush your teeth, as you have a conversation, pillow talk with your spouse, all of that gets automatically recorded and uploaded to Google. And what Google's ultimate design is, the reason that Google is, I refer to them as the global brain, the reason they're such a frightening company to me is because they've really figured out insidious ways to get access to the most intimate areas of our lives. And I'll give you a couple of examples. I helped to create the private search engine StartPage at StartPage.com. And the reason we created StartPage a number of years back was to give people Google search results without the Google surveillance. And so even when you log on to Google, and I do a daily radio show, and we radio hosts are the most guilty of all because we give this company millions of dollars of free advertising every day when we say Google this or Google that. I say StartPage it on my radio program, because every time you look something up on Google, Google knows exactly who you are, where you're located, and all the previous things that you've searched for. And they actually use their search engine as a kind of lure to get you to go in and deposit information into their computer system. So when they know what your wife cooked for dinner last night, if she looked up the recipe for lamb chops, they know who cuts your hair, because face it, we don't go on the yellow pages anymore and look up phone numbers. We just go into Google and type the name of the hair cutting place. They know every health condition we've ever had, what doctors we've gone to see, because we type all of this unthinkingly into the Google search engine. And what Google figured out probably about 10 years ago is that it's really a powerful way to get personal information about people if you answer all of their questions and quietly sit in the background collecting all the questions. Then you can know essentially everything about everybody. You know their politics, their finances, if they're looking up drug treatment, if they're looking up divorce attorneys, whatever they're looking up, bankruptcy, unemployment insurance. So they know pretty much everything that's going on in our lives from the search engine itself. And then the second thing that Google did, and they did this in 2004, is they said, well, hang on a second. We know so much about people when they think they're in the privacy of their own home. They've got the shades drawn, and they're going on the search engine looking up things they don't want anybody else to know. But wouldn't it be helpful if we could actually listen to people's conversations with one another? What if we could hack into everybody's email? And, of course, that would be illegal. So what they did instead was they invested hundreds of millions of dollars in developing an email program that would reside on their servers so that they could lure everybody into putting their email in the Gmail service where they could watch it all. And that's the sole and only reason why they've created Gmail, so that they would have the ability to have everybody's email in their servers in a system that under their terms of service and the legal contract you agree to when you open a Gmail account says that they can read and store every single keyword, concept, and phrase from your email for their own purposes. And this, again, is what the NSA was getting into under the PRISM program that Ed Snowden was so concerned about, because they built a back door and they said, we want to be able to go in and look at the kinds of personal things that people are talking to one another about in their email. And few people know this about Gmail, Yahoo, and other free email services, but even when you delete a message, they make a copy of it and they keep it for their own records. So if you submit to your, let's say your accountant, you submit your tax returns, then Google will literally open up the tax return, copy down your Social Security number or your national ID number, copy down your income, the names of your dependents, the source of your income, and all of that will be added to this bulging dossier of information that they keep on us. And you probably remember, like, encyclopedias from when we were kids, they would pick up a whole shelf from A to Z.
Sure.
Well, that whole shelf is about the amount of information on every single one of us individually that they've now maintained.
Wow.
And if you imagine going through that, it's just a mind-blowing amount of information. So what I tell people is if it's smart, it's surveillance. And if it's free, there's a reason why they're giving you the product for free. And the reason is that that's not the product, that's the bait. And you become the product once you take the bait and you give them access to your personal business. And so because of that, after we created Startpage, which, by the way, is serving about 5-6 million searches a day, that is shielding their searches from Google. So people go on Startpage, they type in whatever they want to look up. We submit their search to Google for them. We get the answers back from Google. We delete all the tracking cookies and all the stuff that they use to try to figure out who you are. We give you the results privately, and then we delete all records of your visit. So we don't know who's been on our website or what they've been searching for, and we've been doing this since 2009, delivering fully private search results. We've been third-party certified. We've won awards all across Europe. We like to call ourselves the world's most private search engine. So at startpage.com, you can make it your homepage, add it to your browser, and it's basically a proxy or a way to get to Google without being observed. And then we've done the same thing with email at startmail.com. And actually, listeners can sign up for a 7-day free trial and just give it a try. But with StartMail, we do the same thing that Google does. We give you online webmail. You can use it with your Outlook or Thunderbird program. But we don't read it. And not only that, we give you 3 layers of encryption, so we can't read it, and nobody else can read it either. So it's a fully private way for you to actually take back your email privacy, just like it used to be, just like with the Postal Service. You put it in an envelope, you seal it, they don't deem it open and make a copy. And that's startmail.com.
Catherine Albrecht's here. Now, I know you're a doctor. I'm not sure if you're a psychiatrist, but why do people not listen to your advice? We just have to look at the Ashley Madison incident here in the last little while and how many idiots that there are out there that came back and were probably doing it just as much. And that's just one example of millions as far as privacy and basically throwing everything that we do right, wrong, or in between out into cyberspace. Why do people just ignore it and keep doing it?
Well, I think partly because privacy invasion is tasteless, odorless, and colorless. And so you don't realize that when you go onto Google, you've got the shades drawn, and you wouldn't want anybody to look over your shoulder and see what you're looking up. You don't realize that you'd probably be better off if your neighbor were watching you through a telescope to look that up, because at least your neighbor would be likely to forget it or eventually move away.
Sure.
Google hangs on to this stuff for all eternity. And at that point, it winds up in the hands of the Chinese government actually hacked into Gmail accounts in order to arrest Chinese dissidents and put them in labor camps. So this could literally mean your life if you're not careful. And I think the reason people are willing to do it is because it's kind of like if I just close my eyes and plug my ears and hum, I don't have to think about what's really going on because you don't see it. And they've hidden it. They've become extraordinarily good at really hiding from people what's really going on, what's really happening with these services. And so it's not only Gmail and Yahoo and Google and search engines, it's also the apps on our phones. And this is a really important thing for people to realize. If it's free, there's a catch. And that's really the rule for 99% of the Internet. If it's free, there's a catch. Now, it used to be in the old days, if you remember the old days of Yahoo and AOL and Earthlink and all those old emails,
yep,
that the catch would be they'd give you free email, but then there'd be an ad at the bottom.
Sure.
So your friends would have to receive some dumb ad for something they probably didn't care about. And that's a normal catch. Like your free recycler newspaper, the catch is it's full of ads. The catch with whatever, you watch TV, it's free. Well, it's full of ads. But how is it that all of these apps on your phone don't have ads? What is the catch? And there is a catch. And the catch is that if you look at the fine print on most of the apps that are free on your phone, you will find that they're helping themselves to your entire contact list. And that means I've got an unlisted phone number. If you were to put my phone number in your phone and then install one of these apps, let's say Angry Birds or some other kind of app, and you put it on your phone, then voila, my phone number is no longer unlisted because now Catherine Albrecht and my unlisted phone number are in the hands of these marketers. Many of them nowadays are third world or even former Eastern Bloc countries, and they're run by hackers.
Jeez.
Who actually try to find the killer app, the thing that's so exciting, you got to put it on your phone, And then once you put it on your phone, you've installed malware, literally spyware, onto your phone that lets them monitor your location, all your purchases, all your web surfing habits, all your contacts, every personal piece of information on your phone they can grab, they do. And so we need to be very careful whenever we're installing so-called free software. This is why I'm a big believer in, hey, pay 50 cents, pay a buck, pay $3, and there's a pretty good chance that the software you're going to get if you pay $3 is going to be legitimate, because they're making money. You got to figure out, how are they going to make money? And if you're not the customer, somebody else is the customer, and you're being used.
We're just about out of time. And listen, I really appreciate you coming on, and we'll have to do this again. We could probably spend the whole show just on this, on this topic. But I want to talk a little bit about you, and you also write books, and tell us the project that you're working on or what you've been doing.
Well, thank you. I'm a Christian, and one of the things my grandmother warned me about when I was a little girl was a time when everybody would have to have a number to buy or sell. And, of course, we all do nowadays with credit cards and PayPal and Bitcoin and who knows what. But back in the 1970s, that was just inconceivable to me. So I promised her I would never take this mark on the right hand or the forehead the Bible describes called the mark of the beast. And I thought, yeah, in thousands of years I'll tell my children and they'll tell their grandchildren and my descendants won't take it. Little did I know that I would actually live through a period of time that's happening right now, the first period in human history where we actually have the technological capability of putting a mark and a number on every single person on the planet. And we've actually got people literally doing this, putting bitcoins into microchips implanted in their hands so they can buy stuff. Jeez. And so I've written a children's book. It's called I Won't Take the Mark, and it's to enable grandparents to give their grandchildren and parents to give their kids the same message and the same warning about biblical prophecy that my grandmother gave to me. And you can find the book. It's beautifully illustrated, King James, beautiful watercolor pictures. It's very uplifting. It's got a positive ending. You can find it at virtuepress.com, and you can also go to Amazon and just look up I Won't Take the Mark. And one of the things that comes with the book is a certificate. It's 8x10, beautifully illustrated. You and the child both sign it, and they promise only to worship God, never to take the mark of the beast, and to call on Jesus Christ to help them keep their promise. And that's really the cornerstone of the book. And I've got frames coordinating with those beautiful gift packages with gift wrap. So if you've got a child that you want to warn about the dangers of technology, it's the perfect gift. It's at virtuepress.com. And if you get a gift package, we throw in the gift wrapping and a beautiful card. You get the frame, and the child looks at it every single day as they're growing up. So if in the future somebody says, hey, take this mark in your hand to buy and sell, they'll know, hey, wait a minute, that was predicted in the Bible 2,000 years ago. Not going to do it.
Sounds fantastic. Catherine, thank you, and hopefully we'll be in touch again soon.
It's been a real pleasure. God bless you and your listeners.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Dr. Catherine Albrecht talking about technology, safety, and how we're being tracked and traced, and it's unbelievable. Off air, we were talking about how there's a capsule now that you can swallow that will tell your doctor everything that you've been eating and putting into your body. I don't know. It's crazy. Like I said, I had a Betamax VCR that I didn't know how to set the clock on. In fact, I still got it. Anybody interested? Anyway, this is the Dana Pretzer Show. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. It's stories like this always get to you a little bit, truthfully. And I'm sure my guest is probably saying that's not the first time I've heard that. The book, Fractured, Not Broken, Overcoming Setbacks with a Vengeance, a real-life story of heroic virtue, is about my next guest. Her name is Kelly Schaefer. Kelly, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you here today, too. Now, when we talk about faith and overcoming setbacks and all that, we'll be able to tell your story, and I want you to tell the audience a little bit about yourself before we get going.
Yeah, well, my name is Schaefer, and I'm from Jasper, New York. And 16 years ago, I was hit by a drunk driver at the age of 19. And after the accident, I went into physical therapy and things like that, trying to regain movement because I was diagnosed as quadriplegic. And so I have been wheelchair bound for 16 years. And since the accident, I have overcome my setbacks and my obstacles by going back to college to become a teacher. I also got married 6 years ago. And just recently, we adopted two children from Africa. And this last year, my aunt and I wrote a book entitled Fractured, Not Broken. And it's a memoir, a Christian memoir, about my story. And the title just kind of means, you know, obviously my spine was fractured, but my spirit has not been broken. And, it's an uplifting book. Obviously, there's some tragedy in it, but overall, it's a very heartfelt book.
You know, nobody expects things like this to happen to them, and I'm sure that day you never expected that your life would turn this corner. And faith, I'm sure, has such a huge part in your recovery, so to speak. But let's go back to that day, if we could. What do you remember about it?
Well, we were on a family vacation in Durango, Colorado, and it was the last night of the family vacation, and we were going to have a good time with the rest of the Dude Ranch staff, and we went out around 9:30 at night. The staff members, along with my brother, Jason, and my boyfriend at the time. And within 10 minutes of our drive, we were all stopped by a drunk driver who was crossing the center line and hit us head-on, killing the driver of our car, injuring several others. My brother, Jason, has a brain injury, and my boyfriend at the time broke his arm and had a lot of stitches. And so the drunk driver tested 0.18 and the legal limit is 0.08.
Yeah.
And so he received 9 years in jail.
I'm curious, Kelly. The point of impact, all the time in the hospital. When did you know, or how soon did you know that you would become your injuries were so catastrophic that you are now a quadriplegic?
Yes. We knew right away. Right away after the x-ray, it showed the fracture of 4 vertebrae, very high up on the spine, which was never a good thing. And my spinal cord was bruised, and so they knew that the outcome of walking was not likely. And so they right away told me I broke my neck and that I was paralyzed from the neck down, and that you would know how much more movement you would get about a year after the injury, but it was unlikely to regain full mobility. And I can move my shoulders, my left arm, but I have no finger movement, and I have no leg movement.
You're 19. Your whole world is ahead of you. At that time, how much of a depression, I'll use that term, set in once you had that diagnosis?
I was kind of, being young, you're so naive. And so you just think things are going to get better no matter what.
Right.
And I just kind of, I had great friends and great family that just kept moving forward and never saying, like, why did you get in the car? Or if only this didn't happen. And there wasn't a whole lot of time to just sit and cry, even though I did cry, but nobody was pitying me. Nobody would sit and really agree that this is a sad thing. They just said, you know, we can't change it, let's move on. And that's what I did. And there's still hard times. Yes, it was hard the first year, but every day is a choice of whether or not I can do this or not.
Yeah, Kelly Schaefer's here. We're talking about her memoir, fractured, not broken. And you used the term, or the term overcoming setbacks with a vengeance. Now, sometimes when we use that term vengeance, we think of it in a negative way, but this was positive. This was strength. Where did that strength come from, Kelly?
Yeah. Well, the strength obviously first came from God. Totally did not heal me. And that's what I prayed for. But he gave me the strength and the peace to get through every day. And I look back and I, how did I do it? And that's who I give all the credit to. The supporting cast would be my family and my friends who just uplifted me, distracted me, entertained me, and gave me hope as well.
The term strength comes from within, I think, is an accurate term, and you have to have that, like you say, supporting cast around you to keep you motivated, keep you going. Was there ever a time where you just said, nah, this isn't going to work?
No. I mean, I'd say that even at my lowest point, I still felt like I had more to achieve, or I felt like, you know, I could see the light at the end of the tunnel and that things were going to be okay, even though it was hard to get through. I mean, I'd say maybe at the very beginning, right when I heard the diagnosis, I'm like, no, because I picture Christopher Reeve in my mind and him in his wheelchair and everything he has to go through or went through, and I just thought, I cannot do that. But I think God equipped me with what you need, and that's what he did. And I don't know how I do it every day. I don't. So.
Well, it's strength and it's faith, my dear, and you're able to now teach. You're married. You've been able to accomplish so much in life. When you decided to do the memoir, what pushed you in that direction? Because memoir stories are usually something that we tell to try and either entertain or to benefit others, and I'm sure you're wanting to do both.
Right, and my aunt, Michelle Weidenbender, who wrote Fracture Not Broken, is an author, and she's published several books. And so she was really the push behind publishing this book, the push that I needed, because I don't know if I could have done it on my own. And also, not just her wisdom, but when I met my husband, really completed my story and made it such a positive one, such an uplifting one, and such one, that everybody just kind of felt that it needed to be in writing. And so Michelle and I just got together and worked on it for about a year and longer, and put it out there, and it's been well received, and we are so happy that it is, that it's doing well, and we hope to inspire a lot of people.
I want to talk to you a little bit about drunk driving itself, judges, communities, politicians, law enforcement, defense lawyers. Everyone can talk the talk, so to speak, but until you become a victim like yourself, and I'm sure you don't like hearing that term, can we get a true assessment of your thoughts on the problem of drunk driving then and today? Can I get those thoughts from you?
Yeah. I mean, I really think the problem is that everybody thinks that they're okay and that they've only had a couple.
Right.
And so there's a gray area. And the law with the .08 gives you that gray area by saying, like, I mean, how do we really know? Are we .06? Are we .05? How do we know? So I feel like either you drink and you find a ride home, or don't drink and you drive home. So I feel like there's not a, there are one or two limits. I feel like it's either, it's black or white.
You're right, and that's just it. And if there was a perfect world, we could wave our magic wands and make sure that anybody who has had something to drink does not get in behind the wheel of a vehicle and drive, because that potential of tragedy is just there. What about punishment? Now, you say that the individual received 9 years, I believe. Are we too strict? Are we too lenient? What more could be done?
You know, I don't know. I would feel like it would be great if it thought that your license was taken away for some time, and that doesn't happen. And sometimes jail time doesn't happen. And I also realize that good people can be, you know, can make a mistake. But I just feel like if the consequences were greater, that these mistakes would be fewer. And so what those are, I don't know. But I do think that there needs to be a deeper penalty.
That's so true. I'm a consequences kind of person myself. And usually when we grew up, if we did something wrong, the consequences were to that point where we knew that we shouldn't do it again. But that's something that the courts need to decide. And that's in itself is a whole story that we could spend a whole hour talking about. Now, we're just about out of time, unfortunately, but I want to talk a little bit about faith. And for the person that's listening to the program, either live or on podcast or picks up your book to read and all of that, and they have something in the back of their mind or in front of them right now that's causing them so much grief, a physical impairment or a problem with a family, a loved one or themselves, or a medical diagnosis, what about faith and what can we tell them to try and keep that faith?
Well, I would say, you know, that God won't give you more than what you can handle. And that for some reason he thought I was pretty tough and I could handle this. And that really the ultimate goal in life is to get to heaven. It's not to walk and to be healthy on earth and receive this physical grace back again. But it's really to get to heaven. And so to try to know that there is a reason for everything and that you didn't do anything wrong and God's not punishing you, but somehow it's part of his plan.
The memoir is called Fractured, Not Broken by Kelly Schaefer and Michelle Weinbenner. And listen, you have so much strength and so much perseverance that if you could bottle it, I would buy that bottle because we all need that. And thank you for coming on the program, and hopefully we can talk again soon.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You know, when you talk about this, she was 19 when it happened. She had a basketball-playing boyfriend, and they were her whole life ahead of her. And a drunk driver in that split second took her mobility. She's a quadriplegic, but she's been able to turn that around and do something for not only herself, but for family and for others. And this memoir, Fractured, Not Broken, by Kelly Schaefer and Michelle Weinbenner, is just a story about how drunk driving, that terrible disease, that terrible scourge that's out there, can turn around and can have sometimes sad but positive outcomes. And Kelly is certainly an example of that. Well, that's it. That's tonight's show. I hope you enjoyed it here on Access 7 and on Scared Monkeys Radio, and we'll see you again real soon.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.